Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba, Asheda, Mojuba, Aluwa, Mi, Apolabi, Pega, Mojuba, Araba, Mi, Adesanya, Awuyade, Mojuba, Ogute, Compound, Ode, Remo, Mojuba, Baba, Mojuba, Yeye, Mojuba, Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba, Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba, Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe, O. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. It's Late Light Listen In session here on New Power Radio Network. We had some technical difficulties earlier in the evening. We usually broadcast at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but because of those technical difficulties, we decided to have a late night session tonight. So I hope you enjoy. Part one is Sonya Gibson Ranking speaking at the UNM Civil Rights Colloquium, Significant Voices, Women of Equal Rights and Sexual Justice. And then part two is Great Black Women in History. So I hope you all enjoyed tonight's listening session, and I hope you all learned something from it, because I certainly did. This is Queen Tahira thanking you for listening to Sign of the Times New Power Radio Network, and we also ask that you please support our sponsors, Manhood Raising Culture and Unity Design. Please reach out to them on the World Wide Web. Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E, unitydesign.com, and manhoodraiseculture.com. We'll talk to y'all tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at our regularly scheduled time. Peace.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Baca, for that introduction. I appreciate you speaking on my behalf. Thank you, Dr. Michelle Coles and Dan Cryer and Stephanie, for all of your hard work. I think this is absolutely fantastic that they constantly make these opportunities available to the University of New Mexico campus. Ms. Baca and I were just laughing that it doesn't come out of poli-sci, it doesn't come out of minority studies, it doesn't come out of the law department, it comes out of the English department, who wants to keep civil rights conversations alive. So we would like to thank you guys for your hard work and for what you guys do. Before I begin, I'd like to bring some sad news to the academic community as a whole. John Hope Franklin, a towering scholar and pioneer of African-American studies who wrote the seminal text on the Black experience in the United States and worked on the landmark Supreme Court case that outlawed public school segregation, died yesterday at 94 years old. Dr. Franklin published a pinnacle book on history entitled From Slavery to Freedom, which documented how blacks lived and served alongside whites from the nation's birth. Black patriots fought at Lexington and Concord, crossed the Delaware with Washington, and explored with Lewis and Clark. The book sold more than 3.5 million copies and remains required reading in college classrooms. It was when I went to undergrad. From Slavery to Freedom is a pinnacle text even at 60 years old. It is based on research Franklin conducted in libraries and archives that didn't even allow him to eat lunch or use a bathroom in their facilities because he was black. History is richer because of him, our nation is stronger because of him, and our future will not be as documented because of his loss. John Hope Franklin was a pioneer for black studies, and he will be missed. If you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to take time out to not just talk to you, but I want you to give you some new things to think about and some ponderings that I go through. Email came out shortly before the election of our President Barack Obama with a new power slogan for the black community. It read, Rosa sat so Martin could walk. Martin walked so Obama could run. Obama's running so our children can fly. Oh, wow, we felt empowered. Wow, we felt invigorated. But I felt like something was missing. It didn't go deep enough. It didn't go far enough. It didn't hit the root. And it came to me. It was missing the full story, the true legacy, the true beginning. I propose to you to start that phrase with a better intro. Septima taught so Rosa knew how to sit. Who's Septima? Ah, that's my whole point. Septima Clark, and we're going to talk about her a little bit later on. The unsung heroines, the countless masses, the driving force behind change in the black community, from slavery to freedom, to revolution to hope. Today I want to not only talk about the quest for equality and justice in the black female community during the late 1960s and 70s, but how that quest was shaped over the nurturing and the creation of our history of the nation. Paula Giddings crafted the benchmark text on the study of black women in America in 1984. When and Where I Enter, the Impact of Black Women on Race and Sex in America, told a story that many had not heard before. Now picture this version of America with me. Although black women gained freedom after the Civil War, their capabilities were not recognized and they were limited to the same opportunities afforded them during slavery. Some opportunities did arise for them to go to college. Let's not forget those women. I believe the first black woman passed the bar in the 1880s. She was allowed to practice law, maybe in D.C. So there were opportunities for women to get into pharmacy. We all know Madam C.J. Walker and certain small segments of the population. But for the large bulk, they were still working in those tobacco and rice and indigo and cotton fields. They were still doing domestic home care and menial work. Black women were barred from industrial labor force for more than a century. From the 1830s to the 1930s, they were not allowed to work in the factories. Now, what was happening in those early 1900s in the factories? Well, a lot of women were going onto those factory lines because their men were being shipped off to war. So we're starting to see that even when they needed people to fill those slots, they didn't give those slots to black women. Before the turn of the century, clerks and secretary positions were just starting to open up to women. Imagine a time they didn't think women were smart enough to be secretaries. You go back far enough, they didn't think we were smart enough to be teachers. It's fascinating stuff. But even when those opportunities were opening up for white women, they still were not opening up for the black women in America. Black women activists at the turn of the century traversed a tricky and sometimes contradictory path in responding to the challenge to agree with the fundamental premises of the Victorian ethic, known as true womanhood. Ah, we're going to come back to that when we get into the 1960s. But they had a problem because they were still fighting with the racist and the classist implications of what true womanhood actually means. For Black women, they were fighting so hard to fight to be ladies that they forgot about the other women on their own side in different classes. What would have happened in the late 1800s if Black women and white women would have been able to work together? Where would we be as a nation if Black women would not have been tossed under the buggy, horse and cart, and kind of left behind by the Black male abolitionists and left behind right after that by the white female suffragists? They really weren't allowed. Well, we got a glimpse of what almost could have been in an old friend of mine named Sojourner Truth. And I just think she, and can you picture this woman? She's over 6 feet tall. And she's, you know, worked in the field, so she's got her biceps, you know, she's got the Michelle Obama arms we're all after. And, you know, can you picture her getting up and speaking to people and the murmuring? What was she going to talk about? She got in front of, in Akron, Ohio, and an 1851 women's rights meeting. Now, 1851, we're going before the end of slavery, and she gets up to talk about Ain't I a Woman. And there are a couple of different accounts of what happened, but I think that the crux of what she was sharing that day was, I deserve to be treasured. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. We must remember also that there were not just schisms, there were also schisms in the white community. The white females were still struggling with this idea of class. They saw classism was there, but they weren't quite ready to touch it. They weren't ready to grasp it. They weren't really ready to challenge it. And of course, we're going to see that rise in it again. Giddings argues that the partings of the 1840s and the 1850s was inevitable, not just because of white racism, but for Black women, at the time, racial equality was a top priority. Sojourner Truth had stated that Black women already proved that they had the inherent strength to accomplish anything, and there was just this internal struggle that was always going on, should I be fighting for the freedom of my race or the freedom of my gender? That's been a big problem. Frederick Douglass, to tell you the truth, was a male feminist, and he was a big believer in fighting for Black women's rights and women's rights, and he was trying to explain to the white female community why these Black women were going to problems, and they pondered back to him, well, they're being attacked because of who they are. He's like, yeah, but they're being attacked not because they're women, but because they're Black. And it always came back to this question. It was always a challenge, and it was always a struggle. And to tell you the truth, we are seeing those exact same conversations still taking place today. The 15th Amendment in 1867 gave free men of color the right to vote. Now, when you join my civil rights movement class next semester, we'll talk about what really came out of the 15th Amendment. But at this time, remember, we're only giving free men of color the right to vote. This did not bode well for these suffragist women that had been working so hard and so diligently to get women the right to vote. And keep in mind, it won't be until 1920 that women do get the right to vote. And this right to vote divided the Black feminist community. And we can call people like Sojourner Truth and Frances Ellen Harper Black feminists because they were arguing on behalf of equality. And we get that term feminist, and it kind of puts some people on edge, and then said, oh, here they go again. We're not going that way. I just want you guys to understand something deeper that the word meant, that the term was referring to. A sense of equality, a sense that you look at me and you don't see what I'm made up of, but what's inside me that I'm made up of. Now, there are some women in that early feminist group who didn't, how do I say it nicely, didn't really care for the advancement of Black women or lower class women at that time. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, oh, you should read up on her. There's a reason Susan B. Anthony got the coin that she didn't. There are some things that people look at. There are some inner qualities that they had or didn't have that were a big deal. So what was really the first issue that Black feminist leaders put at the top of their agenda was really this battle to defend their moral integrity simply as women. Primarily the stereotypes that wouldn't die. From the asexual mammy, to the hypersexual Jezebel, to the sexually demotivating Sapphire. She just couldn't get away from this issue of sex and who she was. So they felt that they had to put all of their effort just to say, ain't I a woman, and what those things mean. This goes back to that true womanhood. And to tell you the truth, when Toni Morrison wrote her piece, What the Black Woman Thinks About Women's Lib, in 1971, she poses to you the the segregationist signs that were up. White ladies and colored women. That's deep. That's deep. Could say white women and colored women, but it didn't say that. White ladies and colored women. White ladies were ladies worthy of respect. The quality that made ladyhood worthy? Softness, helplessness, and modesty. Colored females, on the other hand, were women. Unworthy of respect because they were tough, capable, independent, and immodest. This is that topic that's going to continue to recycle, and we still are discussing it. We've come across the video vixens today, or I've heard more negative terms, so I won't say that because my mom's going to watch the video. In 1893, however, we're presented with really that first opportunity for an interracial forum. But black men were not allowed to speak at the convention because it was only for national organizations. I love how the rules start popping up when people start showing up. Oh, I'm so sorry. You're not a full organization. Where's your charter? Where's your bylaws? I'm sorry. You guys are just making it up. Come back when you guys can get organized. And the organizers only allowed people that they thought were safe, exceptions, to speak. What happens when you only pick the safe people? You don't get any dialogue. You don't get anything changed. There were a lot of things that were going on, and at this time, black women turned to class-based clubs as a vehicle for social and political recognition. Once again, those class-based clubs. And this is something that can't be ignored in the black community, is really these topics of these paper bag tests, these pencil tests, where paper bag tests, for those of you that aren't familiar, is when they would hold your face up to a brown paper bag. If you were darker than the brown paper bag, you were not given admittance. They would stick a pencil in your hair. If that pencil stayed, you were not given admittance. If it slipped, you were given admittance. If it only slipped a little, well, maybe you can cook. They find all kinds of ways to find ways to diversify and to come up with ways to stop the people from moving forward. Post-war, you know, we're getting now to the end of the end of World War I, World War II, and really the nation felt a boom. Why was there this boom that was happening across the nation? Well, we've got that GI Bill coming out. What did that GI Bill do? It gave able-bodied men who had served in the services money to put down on a house, a way to get education. And I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, these are the three things I want you to remember if you remember nothing else. How do we get a people to move forward? Education or access to knowledge, means to get capital, and a way to save that capital. If we don't have those three, a people will never move forward. A family will never change. They will never get off the trajectory of the classism that they've been placed onto. And without all three of those things, it doesn't matter how smart you are, if you can't put together an extra $2 a week to start to save towards a change, nothing's going to happen. It doesn't matter if you've saved all the money in the world, you're the smartest person in the room. If the bank looks at you and says, on the telephone, you're approved, and in person, you're denied, there's still no way for you to move forward. So without those three things, the people cannot move forward. But I want you guys to feel, we're going to have to fast forward now to the Civil Rights Movement, but I want you to keep in mind that during this time, that time of Jim Crow, that time of extreme segregation, when grown women were referred to as auntie, when they were not called by their given names, when they were told to bow their head or else they were seen as uppity, during that time there were still segments and moments of growth and of change and of women who wanted to make a difference, both black women and white women. Women like Ida B. Wells and her endless fight to end systematic lynchings throughout the South. Women like Dr. Septima Poinsett Clark and her work for equal access to education and civil rights for African Americans decades before we ever got to a conversation on racial inequality. Women like Mary McLeod Bethune, one of my favorites. She's known as the First Lady of the Struggle. Now, we talk about Aretha, she's the First Lady of Soul, but the First Lady of the Struggle. And then we've got another word for Rosa Parks, but Dr. Septima Clark, known as the grandmother of the civil rights movement. Mary McLeod Bethune, First Lady of the Struggle. And another woman who is actually getting pretty near and dear to my heart, Eleanor Roosevelt. No woman has ever been more interesting, I think, in our American history because of her position and what she did with the role of First Lady. Sorry, Michelle Obama's on her way. But she was in a position, because of her life and because of the challenges she went through, she was in a position as the foremost champion of human rights for the people that did not have a voice. And really, if you want to have a lot of fun with this, I would recommend you guys check out Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's written a number of great historical novels, and her novel on this is No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the Home Front in World War II. But, you know, it's interesting because when she first met Mary McLeod Bethune and they became friendly, she still couldn't bring herself to greet her with a kiss as she did her other friends. It was still a lot of growth that she had to have to get over the assumptions she had about black women. Now let's understand America in the early 1960s. Where did black women feel they had a voice? let's start. Let's go back to the civil rights movement and their treatment of black women, and also black women of their treatment during the black nationalist movement. The black women's networks were central to the struggle of the civil rights movement. Well, why is it? Because of all those clubs they formed. Those clubs kept them busy. They gave them a place, gave them a way to have a voice. So when action needed to happen, well, they didn't have email, they didn't have text. They were going old school, maybe party lines in the South. Anyone remember those old party lines when you pick up the phone and wait your turn? But they found ways to get the message across to their other females in their clubs that change is needed. Let's scan the historical images of the most dramatic moments of the civil rights movement. We were just watching this in class this morning. Protesters blasted with fire hoses, dogs lunging at blacks. There were women and young girls in all of those images everywhere. There's another image, a 1964 image of a Mississippi beautician who's styling hair and educating her customers on voter registration. There's no better place in America to know what is happening than the beauty salon, the barber shop. That's where the conversations are happening. That's where they're handing out flyers. And it's still happening today. It's absolutely amazing that these networks are still in place. Hey, before you leave, sign this petition. Hey, before you go, you need to be aware of these problems that are happening in the community. They got you in the chair for 3 hours. You might as well talk about something. Now, great men such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, who we know as Malcolm X, they became great icons of the 1950s and 60s. But the organizational skills and grassroots activism of women propelled the movement forward to many successes and inspired a new generation of activists. Their invisibility as leaders within the movement have been exacerbated by the tendency to define leadership as belonging only to those with public speaking roles. And that's really interesting because it ties into what we're talking about in class on Tuesday. Can I be a leader if you never hear me say anything? And I think that's something that we have to learn as women to find voice with and to find a way. The different methods of influence that we're able to use even without raising a fist. But that's another day. Now, we all know what happened in December of 1955 on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, only 4 months after Emmett Till was found mutilated in Mississippi. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat for a white man in Montgomery, Alabama. This sparked a mass boycott by thousands, mainly black women domestic workers who had long filled the bus's back seats. Thousands and thousands and thousands of black women who had to go to work every day. I don't think we can appreciate today the work that these women had to do. Because it's not just the fact that I've got to go across town. You guys may not know the South, but there's a line. And when we hear those phrases, wrong side of the tracks, there's a certain kind of people on one side and a certain kind of people on the other side. You've got to get across town to your place of employment, spend all day there raising someone else's kids, cleaning someone else's home, get back and raise your own children that you've already had. How are they going to do that when the welfare office is knocking on the door and says, oh, you're not working enough hours. You need to get more jobs. I'm already cleaning 3-4 houses a week, not enough. You need to clean a house every day. I can't make them make me clean their houses. So there's this real struggle because it's not just the fact that they've got to do this work, but they've got to do this work to survive. They found a way for over 380 days to not take their normal mode of transportation. Now, why do I think this is hilarious? Because one of the major groups to help fight this were their white employers. Their husbands said, will you stop giving those black women rides to work? We're trying to break them. And they said, look, who's going to clean this house? And they would go across town, they would get their maid, they would get their maid's friends, and they'd drop them all off to their friend's house and back and forth. These odd networks that form, there's no better conversation than the conversation of the Southern Belle and the Mammy and that relationship and that dynamic that is in place. Great area to study. But these black women also relied on each other. They created carpools. They sold cakes and pies and raised money for alternative transportation. Now, who are they going to sell cakes and pies to? To each other. I've only got 10 dimes, but I'm willing to give you one, and I'm not just going to give you the money. Your pride wouldn't allow for that. I'm going to take your pie, I'm going to give you a dime that's going to help you make moves, and they're just moving that same 10 cents all around the community so that everybody gets a chance. Interesting, though, there were 4 women who had been arrested before Rosa Parks. Oh, Claudette Colvin, we cannot forget her. I will not let her be forgotten. 15-year-old young lady who refused to give up her seat on Montgomery bus to a white person in violation of the local law. Her arrest preceded that of Rosa Parks by 9 months. In the months that followed the incident, she became pregnant. The NAACP decided that she was not really a reputable face for the movement. Civil rights movement, we talk about the uglies of the community and who we choose to back and who we choose not to back. Why would we not back the welfare queen who's strung out on crack, but we'll back the other versions? All these questions of feminism and who do we really want to support? We'll get to that at the end. But they, keep in mind, really, that the women were had spearheaded the campaign and many others in their efforts, and those efforts were really taken over once they really got going by men in the community. In 1963, tens of thousands of women who joined the March on Washington witnessed a tribute to prominent women, songs by several women, and brief remarks by the entertainer Josephine Baker. But no woman made a speech. That was not odd. Women that were doing all of the prep and all of the background were not given a chance to speak on that very fateful day. We all get locked into Dr. King's speech, and it's a great speech. He did a really great job. But we don't keep track of the other ones who spoke also on that day and the other topics they wanted to share and the voices we never heard. And some of the voices we didn't hear were countless women who could have spoken. Ella Baker, a charismatic labor organizer and longtime leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Septima Poinsett Clark, who was known, as I said, as the Queen Mother of Civil Rights. Fannie Lou Hamer, Mississippi sharecropper, talk about that wrong side of the tracks, who was beaten and jailed in 1962 for trying to register to vote. Vivian Malone Jones, who defied segregationist Governor George Wallace, enrolled in the University of Alabama in 1963 and later worked in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department. Really, some women that had a few good things to say, you would think, didn't get an opportunity. And always, always, we cannot forget those countless faces. Those women in the churches who cooked for all those children who were being arrested, who made sure they had food, who would send blankets, who put their houses up as bond money so they could get out of jail. All of those women were important. We get to the Black Nationalist Movement, and really this came at the as the Civil Rights Movement was, I won't say winding down, but going down a different path as times were really changing. Things got a lot different at this time. Things really started to change. Keep in mind that when Black women were involved in the Civil Rights Movement, they were involved in non-traditional ways also. Oh yeah, they cooked and they cleaned. But they were also, they went to jail, they were beaten in jail, they handled bus boycotts, they were field project leaders, they did voter registration drives, they challenged state and National Democratic Party leadership. But we got to the Black Nationalist Movement and things started to change. The social base of the movement changed. It became younger and more northern. So the southern community base that had fostered women's participation was less important as the student movement kind of took over. The previous movement had relied on mature women who were part of the previously existing community organizations and churches. The shift meant that they didn't have a voice as much as the movement changed. This bridge leadership that we kind of lost, and which is still, to tell you the truth, missing today, the sense that there's someone ahead behind you, or ahead of you, who's gonna tell you, here's how we do it. Here's what we learned. Someone who, the same person who taught Rosa Parks how to sit on that bus and say no, is missing today. There are the women who are willing to undergird the current movement. And some of those, and there were shifts in opportunities. Some of the organizations that worked so well in the South, as we know, did not really take hold in the North. We realized that those, the fighting for to vote didn't really matter in the North. They've been voting for years, but they were still dead broke. We get into that de facto, de jure segregation that is a major difference. It doesn't matter what rules are on your books. If your rules say I have the right to live anywhere, I should be able to, but they could not. Black women were basically given a supportive role in the Black Nationalist Movement, while black men were kept the revolution because the purpose was to help him reclaim his black manhood, which had been stolen from him. And black women at the time were willing to some extent to say, we'll give you this opportunity to find your sense of self. But there were a lot of things going against them at this time, because this Black Nationalist Movement was a lot of fun. I mean, the men were like, okay, we can write rules. All right, the rules we're going to pick. And there was this project called the Mohean Report that was basically saying the problem with the black family is all these black women leading these black families. But for them, if we only gave black men the right to lead, we would get a different turn. And that really didn't sit well, because the same time the black nationalists said, that report's a bunch of garbage, it's a racist piece, and we're not going to follow it, they said, oh, the problem is that black men aren't leading families. That's where the root is. And they decided to implement a lot of things. Women, stop putting relaxer in your hair. Stop wearing jewelry. Stop wearing makeup. Start doing these things. Start taking this subjective role. And the black woman said, I've been working every day of my life, as has the last four generations of my family. What are you expecting me to get into? And they were really arguing that for black women who had traditionally and historically worked outside of the home, this new typical middle class person that their men wanted them to be didn't jive well. It worked into a staying at home, buying consumer products. It didn't fit with what they were doing, and they all sounded like, as they thought, coming out of the pages of a ladies' home journal. It's a great article if you ever have a lot of fun to play on the internet. out of the 60s on what you should do when your man comes home in 1962. Have the house. Has anyone seen that? I guess you, you have. I know some men that keep it on the fridge and the wives take it down and they put it back, and the ongoing battle. But, you know, have his drink ready. Have the kids away and cleaned up. Have everything, you know, in order. Don't bother him with the problems of your day. He's had a long enough moment. Let him speak. So there was really the sense that they're like, you're not taking me down that road. I read that article too. And despite that great personal loss, African-American women still had a long tradition of civil and human rights activism. Women like Angela Davis, Marion Wright Eldeman, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and Alice Walker. There was a book written by Gloria Hull called But Some of Us Are Brave, Black Women's Studies. And she really pulls out the fact that this black feminist movement grew out of a response to the black liberation movement and the women's movement. It was really an effort to help them feel less racially oppressed in the women's movement and less sexually oppressed in the black liberation movement. And the quote kind of goes, all too often, black was equated with black men, and women was equated with white women. And so as a result, they really felt that there was no one who said that they belonged, they existed, they had a voice. Black women were being discriminated on all sides, and they really moved, and you know, I'm gonna make it broad, you know, I'm not just gonna limit it to the black nationalist movement, but the civil rights movement, the Black Panthers, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and others of that group, all still were running into this issue of how to find true equality. Some argue that it was really a quest for the black men to control the black woman's sexuality, to say when and where and who and how. Others have argued that the sexual discrimination didn't just come out of misogynist writings, which there were quite a few of that time, but in the actions also. Women were give stories of how they were forced to wait until the men in the organization had eaten. They were told to leave and go clean while they came up with ideas for the movement and for the fighting and issues. So where were the black feminists? Well, really, you know, some argument, people argue, oh, they just weren't interested in the feminist movement. They weren't interested, and that couldn't be further from the truth. They had been fighting on behalf of rights and equality for women, black women, from the 1830s, from Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. You know, Harriet Tubman's another fantastic lady. I think she's great. The way she felt she had to mask who she was in order to be accepted. And once they found out she really was a woman, they said, well, I guess we're out here in the middle of the woods. We might as well keep following her. But when we get now to the black women and the women's rights movement, and back to Toni Morrison, she was very upset in 1971, to speak for lack of a better term. But she really felt that the image that Women's Lib had at the time was of an elitist organization made up of upper middle class women with the concerns of that class, really women trying to get into professional fields and things like that, wasn't really paying attention to the problems of most black women. Not about getting into the labor force, but being upgraded within it. Not about getting into medical school, but getting an adult education. Really almost basic things, we might argue. And black women were still kind of treated a little roughly in 1960 by these feminist organizations. It was generally in the form of exclusion. Well, we'll invite the black feminists to speak when we talk about black issues. Then you'll be more than welcome to come and tell us exactly what are the major feminist topics. They were not equally or even proportionately represented on the faculty of women's studies departments as they were springing up across the country. There weren't many classes devoted specifically to the study of black women, and if you want to get even more detailed, even within those women's discussions that were being had, class was still a very private, very unspoken conversation. Part of the overwhelming frustration was on what they felt was the white feminists' unwillingness to see their own racism in that situation, that they were still stuck into this hierarchical system where they were just trying to find ways to only get themselves into the system and not others. Traditionally, the women's sphere was seen as influence only extended over the home. But if you keep in mind that in 1963, 7 times as many women of color as white women were employed as private household workers. So who were you, what were you really trying to control? They felt that white women were ambivalent to the different perceptions of the struggle concerning the family. In their mind, white women wanted to take the nuclear family apart while black women were trying to protect it, even if their vision from a family differed from the patriarchal structure. Unlike many white women, they felt that the family structure was a way where they were the least oppressed as opposed to what was oppressing them and what was holding them back. Middle class feminists were demanding to work outside of the home. It didn't really speak to black women because, like, well, I've already been working outside of the home. And they had found ways to work outside of the home and still have their family. Things like kinship care, and other mothering and just leaning on Miss Susie down the street to get all the kids after school and get them ready in the morning and things like that. So all these kind of class conversations that weren't really happening. There was a hesitancy to work with white women exclusively on gender. They felt like we can't just talk about gender if we don't discuss race and we don't discuss class oppression. And they felt like, you know, as long as we only do the bread and butter topics, that's fine. You know, just let's stay pretty basic on this, because if we go any deeper, I'm going to have to spend all my time schooling you on the major topics that you don't want to go deep enough on. And that's really how they felt. They were sympathetic to the feminist struggle, but sometimes leery of the white feminists themselves. Now, keep in mind, these black women were not strangers to these white feminists. They watched their mothers clean these women's homes their entire life. They played with them side by side through their toddler years. They could see how privileged and stifled they were. I tell you, once again, that very strange dynamic in the South between black women and white women. They can kind of almost see each other's struggles and pains and still not be able to find a happy medium. But it was that sense of not understanding gender, race, and class oppression that was really bothering people. And no matter how many black families came from middle-class backgrounds, that is still not the same kind of a middle-class background that the white families were coming from. Now, they go even deeper than that. In their mind, it wasn't enough to talk solely about abortion on demand, while divorcing the topic from other issues like reproductive rights that were directly tied to class and racial status, involuntary sterilization, life circumstances that compelled a woman to have to abort, and the possibility that women on welfare would be forced by the state to have abortions. Everyone should understand about the Tuskegee experiment and these forced sterilizations that were taking place all over the South when a doctor felt you had enough kids already. And all of a sudden you're not understanding why you can't have more kids later on. The doctors just were in there, you've got a baby and you'll never have another one. Thank you, have a nice day. This was going on all over the South. So they felt like it wasn't enough to just say, we want abortions when we want them and we want to be able to not have to fly to Puerto Rico. And these other women are arguing that's not deep enough. The topic is deeper. We can't go into these conversations if we don't address poverty. And they also felt like at some point, all your attempts to de-shackle yourself from these creature comforts gets a little annoying. We had this conversation in class of the women are privileged, oh, I just hate being here with my diamonds and my jewels and someone else cleaning my house, this is oppressive. As the person's on their knees scrubbing your floor saying, I understand how oppressed you are, well, how horrible you're in this status. You know, there's something that's not touching me when you tell me how stifled you are when I'm cleaning your floors and I'm raising your kids and I'm breastfeeding your kids. Talk to me about oppression, talk to me about being linked to someone. So when we get into really this sense that, and the women's movement had a couple of things going on for it also. We've got the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission that was starting up, and really the EEOC is what sparked now the National Organization of Women. The EEOC director had a bunch of things that he felt, you know, how these women being included in it, the mistake. He called it it was kind of born out of wedlock. It wasn't supposed to happen. It was kind of a joke. We thought everything would fall apart if we threw women in, and it didn't fall apart. Well, when you start talking like that, women start to not see you as necessarily part of the helping solution. And now the National Organization for Women was founded in 1966 by professional women who served on state commissions on the status of women. But once again, the women who are on this commission, political interest groups, trade unions, women who were already in the system, still were missing that lower class of women that weren't being spoken to. And there was really, now it's very interesting because these organizations, these women that kind of started now, where does anybody know where they got their start? They got their start in the Black Civil Rights Movement. They found a home, they found that they had somewhere to go, and they got into the Black Civil Rights Movement, and they saw how the women were running the show. They were doing the organization, they were getting all the ducks in order, they kept things moving, and they learned on the steps, or at the foot of these bridge leaders that really show them the ropes of how you run an organization, how you do things. And they took those, the same as what happened during the abolitionist era and some of those times, and just shuffled it into their own organization. Women found freedom in SNCC that they didn't find in Students for Democratic Society. They got back to their own organizations filled with white men and said, all right, I know how to do stuff. And they said, no, you don't. Sit down. You're doing what you're already supposed to, just be part of your plan and cook the food and be ready and be prepared to do what we call for. This really led to the spark of the second wave of feminism, as noted by author Bonita Roth, who wrote Separate Roads to Feminism, Black, Chicana, and White Feminist Movements in America's Second Wave, really, really great book because she spends a lot of time discussing what was happening in all three of those different communities. And it was really made up of a little bit of everyone. Now, I don't want us to get locked into the fact that there were racial breakups between these groups because it was a way of the time. And keep in mind that the working class women also felt segregated. It's that classism, once again, that just kept rising up. They still felt they did not have a voice in some of these organizations. And you know, it reminds me of that the book in the movie, He's Just Not That Into You. After a while, as they started to say to the other groups, hey, you know, you should be part of our organization. Just not into you. I feel like we can't connect. Maybe another woman will work better for you. Try the Asians. Try the Natives. See what else you might get a better hit with. Still never really got a mix, but we're going to see some things change as we get to the next generation. So we get to the formation of the Black feminist movement. I tend to think of this as they were faced with two alternatives. Do I devote all my time to educating Black men and white women on all the ways they are not seeing what I'm trying to say? Or do I move to a FUBU mentality? Who knows FUBU? For us, by us. We're going to start our own thing, we're going to run it our way, and we're going to see what we get out of it. And that's really where they found the most, that's where they birthed their first organizations in 1973, the National Black Feminist Organization in New York. And once again, we need to dispel a lot of myths that we have about Black women and feminism. Major myth, Black women are already liberated. They're so strong. We talk about the strong Black woman all the time. She's got it together. She's so productive. Oh, she can just take anything. Well, you know, that's not really liberation. Just because I'm strong doesn't mean I deserve to be treated like garbage. Racism is primarily or the only oppression Black women had to confront. A little bit what Frederick Douglass was telling us 100 years before. But people realized that racism and sexism had to be confronted at the same time. Black women were almost with the mentality that, well, we'll fix this racism thing first, and the Black men will just let us roll right into fixing that sexism thing. It didn't work. They found they were cleaning a lot more houses and doing things of that nature. Next one was that feminism is nothing but man-hating. I wonder if we still hear that one today. And that's not true. You know, really, the fact that I believe I am a strong woman does not mean that I think men are not worthy. I just feel that we should all be treated equally. Not me. This is the writers of the time. Women's issues are narrow, apolitical concerns. They don't address the larger groups. That people of color need to deal with the larger struggle. And that doesn't make sense. If you're oppressed, you're oppressed. And Martin Luther King said it best, knows, I can't be free until my brother's free. I can't feel my sense of who I am until everyone around me is also free. And the final argument was always that feminists are nothing but lesbians. And that's not true at all. It was just that they were a subpart of the same group who felt they did not have a voice. And really, that was considered the triple whammy, if you will, to be Black, female, and a lesbian, where you really felt you had no voice. And even within your own community, you were kept out and separated. And some have argued that really that they were only after that a desire to go over racial inequality. Still not true. Now, think of the three indicators of socioeconomic status: income, education, and occupation. So keep that in mind with your head as we're going through those three major parts of how a person gets ahead. Access to knowledge, access to capital, and a way to save money. And when we're trying to also deal with your income and your education and your occupation, we saw that the typical Black college student was still relatively, may have been privileged in the course of the Black community, but was still in a state of poverty when compared to middle-class white America, and that was still a major problem. Patricia Hill Collins wrote in her writings, What's in a Name? Womanism, Black Feminism, and Beyond. She talked about Alice Walker defining womanist as the alternative to feminism and to feminists. And in fact, they even had a phrase that said, womanism is to feminism as purple is to lavender. We're the richness. We're the history of it. And really, you know, these titles become titles. They become just words that are used, and that can stray people from the topic. It can stray you from the larger argument because now you're locked into this argument. Now, Patricia Hill Collins does a really fantastic job of breaking down why womanism still did not fully speak to the issues and why there are some false issues with this womanist title. But it was really an argument that was going on at the time. Now, Black feminism appeared to be well received by white women. Once they saw the Black women organizing their own perspective, they said, oh, I get it. And we see some of those things happening today. Some of the specific issues that Black feminist movement wanted to work on, once again, reproductive rights, sterilization abuse, equal access to abortion, health care, child care, the rights of the disabled, violence against women, rape, battering, sexual harassment, welfare rights, lesbian and gay rights, aging, police brutality, labor organizing, anti-imperialist struggles, anti-racist organizing, nuclear disarmament, and preserving the environment. So I think we just wanted to fix the world and just do it all in one big group. The words of socialism were thrown around at this time. The words of communism were thrown around at this time. And that can be very distracting, once again, when people start putting titles on change instead of looking at, once again, that bigger, larger picture. The National Black Feminist Organization was founded in May of 1973, and it really was crafted to fill that breach that was created by NOW's failure to address the needs of black women and poor women. And they did a pretty good job of really getting a start. That was in 1973. In 1974, we had the founding of the Combahee River Collective in Boston, which was addressing a lot more of the black lesbian community's needs. And they really just gave voice and gave time to a lot of things. So what do we get into? We started to see a lot of growth. And at this time, black women found that the best way they could have their voice was through the written word. And you start to see a lot of the literature that comes out of that time. Some of our noted black feminist writers of that time, Hazel Carby, once again, Patricia Hills Collins, and Julie Cooper's a little bit older, Julie Dash, Angela Davis, Anne Dussel, Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, Marilyn Mobley, Barbara Smith, quite a few women that really started to give voice through written word and through that avenue. So one thing I keep thinking in mind, though, ladies and gentlemen, when we talk about this womanist and this black feminist debate, it's really only occurring among a relatively privileged group of black women. Now, when we discussed this in class, black women, you know, the theory was that they wanted to bring along the masses. Well, the truth was, is that you realize is that they, the privileged group, were being defined by the, quote, mammies and the Jezebels and the Sapphires. So really, they weren't trying to help these women better themselves. They were like, well, if I'm going to be defined by you, I gotta clean you up. Once again, missing the point. We still have conversations of skin color in this, hair texture, features, and classism that are once again still built into this time. And I want to keep in mind that while these women are debating these topics, there's someone who's doing their dry cleaning, cooking their food, dusting their computers while they have these conversations on titles and topics. So keep in mind, credit markets are frozen today. People cannot get credit. Congress has intervened. They're going to fix it. They're going to open up the credit markets. They're forcing the banks to do what they're supposed to. Hello. How many years and decades have black women and black men and Chicana women and Chicana men and Native people been denied access to that capital? Racial profiling is horrible. How dare you treat those Arab Americans wrong on the airplane? He's just wearing a t-shirt. He's just wearing a turban. He should be treated right. Give him financial compensation for being kicked off that airplane. How many years and decades has there been racial profiling in the streets of America? I feel like we can't forget those things. And, you know, wasn't that long ago? Who remembers some of those comments from Geraldine Ferraro just a few months ago? Mm-hmm. Where were the feminists when poor Michelle Obama was being attacked and treated worse than they treated Hillary Clinton and Anita Hill simply by being married to a guy who was running for office? You know, if we're going to talk fully about equality, all feminism equality, if we're going to open up that door and talk about reproductive rights equality, then we cannot close that door to the octomom. You want to talk equality? What about those quiverful women that want to fill their quivers with their little blessings? Those are the Duggars, if anyone wants to know. 18 and Counting is their new show. So keep in mind, if we're going to talk about feminism, we're going to talk about equality for women, if we're going to talk about the fact that we want the doors open, then let's open those doors. And we have to be fair. Now, 2 seconds. Last thing that's going on is things have changed. Look at the women's studies departments now. You're noticing that the women's movement got it. And they said, black women, Chicana women, Native women, you are welcome. Please come, speak, change, do whatever you need. They have opened up to all their classes these discussions on classism. They really take the time to really deconstruct a lot of the notions that we have. Things are a little slower in some of our other departments. They're still battling those topics in the minority culture studies programs. There's still this issue of when do women really get their voice? Where are those topics being shared and said? And I think that I consider that good change. I consider that great change. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your time.
What role did the church play in the black feminist movement?
Ah, that's good stuff, Mr. Thompson. Thank you. See how these classes are all tying together. I just tell people, you know, it's just all, they all roll into each other. What role does the church play? Foundational role. As we know, you know, but for the black church, there was no other center of the community throughout slavery. And that has still been in place today. We had a great discussion. You should have come to our class. Dr. Hardeman came back again yesterday. No, Tuesday when we had class to discuss the role of women in the church even today and how that role is filled. And it's still, once again, it's a network. It's a community and a community that is extended beyond those blood ties. It becomes something deeper. So the church was, and especially during the Civil Rights Movement, was where the meetings were held. You know, people got to their local church and they had these discussions. The preacher discussed these topics from the pulpit on Sunday morning. Everyone showed back up for Sunday afternoon prayer and Sunday evening shut-ins and whatever else was needed, and they were continually discussing these topics of change. The information did not come from the pulpit, though. I'll tell the truth. The pulpit was quiet on these topics, and it's really still a challenge. It is still a challenge in the black church today for black women to have a visible voice. And you know, you can argue as you choose on what counts as leadership in the church, but gets back to that topic. You know, we tend to see success or leadership as the one doing all the yapping into a mic, and not the people who took the time to get everything set up and organized and the lights are on and there's tablecloths and there's mics that work and all those kind of things. So really, and it's going to be a constantly evolving struggle because of those deeper conversations of religion and the scriptural ties that people tend to go to. And you know, it's funny, anyone can pick up that Bible, turn to the exact same verses, they come up with 2 to 3 to 15 to 20 different interpretations of the exact same set of words. Well, you didn't exegete, you didn't look at the Hebrew, well, you didn't look at the Greek, well, we can't go forward until, you know, I'm only using the new King James Version. That's something completely different than King James or the Reader or the Word or whatever version you choose to use. So really, the church provided a different avenue for black women to have a voice, but it was a different kind of voice. Now, you can argue that by giving their money, they were able to provide a voice. The democratic process that takes place in a lot of the traditional black churches today, where I have the right to go in there and vote as I choose, and I can be super stubborn and hold things back or let you know that my tithes make a difference and things like that. Did I get close? You know me, I go all over.
About the status of the National Black Feminist Group today? Is it growing, vibrant?
It's got a website. Now, take it from there as you choose how websites work. One of my students was doing some research on now, and it's respect to those early traditional black feminist leaders. A little lightweight on some of those women who have pretty heavy roles. Those organizations are not as, the website, I mean, it's a really good looking website, to tell you the truth, but their role is still not as deep. Some of those organizations really hit a pause as the 70s moved out and what they call Reaganomics kind of took over and everyone kind of jumped on that bandwagon and got lost in the shuffle and, you know, people moved to the conversation of the welfare queen and everything got lost after that. Next thing that popped up was crack cocaine and everyone got locked into that and then the crack mom and all those things that popped up. So the organization, and that's funny because I was actually just playing around their website the other day. They've got a website, but their voice is not heard in the larger realm. And I would think that once again goes to this idea of, did you want to say something, Dr. Matthews? Oh, I just think it goes to this idea of really the battle of womanist, black feminist titles and some of those things that lock in. But Dr. Matthews is super expert.
I was going to say, as in the larger community, feminist is a sort of dirty word. So even with young women who would accept claims that are typically identified as feminists, they don't necessarily identify themselves as feminists. So yes, I believe, you know, Title IX is good, women should get equal pay for equal work. They don't necessarily see those as feminist issues or they resist identifying as feminists, even if they agree with those kinds of claims.
I wanted to ask you, just because you mentioned Michelle Obama a couple times, look at that smile. What symbolic role do you see her fulfilling, and what initiatives would you like to see her take on?
Hi, I hope my adventure tomorrow. Initiatives. You know, to tell you the truth, I've been debating that, and I wonder if her face is enough. I don't know. For me, I look at her daughters, and I see my daughters. I look at their cornrows and I see my daughter's cornrows. And I think that says more to this generation of young black women than almost anything. She's not ashamed of her height. She's not ashamed of her color. She's not ashamed of her hair. She works out. That's what we all are waiting for, just to get to the gym and hit the treadmill. So she's fixed some of those major things. And I think her role, to tell you the truth, and it's kind of unfortunate, is simply to show that she is a lady. Now, unfortunately, this goes right back to that idea of true lady, true womanhood, and being a lady versus a woman. But her role, you know, if you think back to that National Democratic speech, when she spent the whole time talking about how much she loves her kids. Well, goodness, of course she loves her kids. They don't have a nanny. But she is a Princeton graduate, a Harvard Law School graduate, and she's got to convince you that she loves her kids and prays for them. I thought that was absolutely ridiculous that she couldn't get up there and say, I could write a couple books. I mean, you know, but for her, for me, it's simply to be that face, and I look at her and I say, get up and go on, get on the treadmill. Michelle Obama can do it, you can do it. But for me, that's what I'm seeing. She's already doing some of those things because it's not necessarily getting up and saying, this is my platform, I'm going to fight on behalf of welfare moms, or I'm going to fight on behalf of things like that. But she goes to the soup kitchen and cooks and talks about it. She's planting a garden and says, the food here is going to go take care of those people I was just over there talking to. She speaks to young Americans like they're not stupid. And she looks at them and says, I don't care if they tell you you're talking white. Keep going and getting your A's. And she looks at them and says, I love you, and I love you, and I love you, and I think you're all worthy. And we're all worthy, and we're all somebody. And I think that's almost, it's refreshing to me. Because at any minute, I know she can put on her lawyer hat and run things, but she chooses not to, and she has the option. But I don't know. But tomorrow we have fun with Michelle Obama. You must have watched Steve Harvey on Oprah this Monday when he talked about act like a lady, think like a man. But, you know, that's absolutely I tell everyone my favorite book. I just love Joan Morgan. I think she's hilarious. When Chicken Heads Come Home to Roost, My Life as a Hip-Hop Feminist, she kind of talks about those things. And it's kind of a new argument to some communities that there is this rising group of black women that have the opportunity to stay at home, and do they choose to? And it's a hard thing because it's hard, to tell you the truth, to learn to turn off your brain to do things that you watch your mother do every single day to make the world happen. And to know that he's going to dump that trash on the nighttime, you don't have to go out there in the morning and do it, and know that the grass is going to be cut, you don't have to worry about it, and know that the bill will be paid or that the kids will be dropped off or that all the other things that happen that might sometimes overlap. And take away some of his freedoms. But it's a hard thing because it's a little different when, if you're not a financial contributor to the household, to kind of defer. It's just a natural kind of thing. Well, you know, you technically bring in the money. My job is to run the home, and I will defer to some of that. But when the woman is bringing in the money, or in some cases in the black community, more than her male counterpart, which is really a major problem. You know, we're watching this trend happening in our universities. I tell you, men have got the... It's their freedom. When my husband and I started undergrad, one of the things they announced in orientation was, brothers, it's 7-1 here, 7-1, disturbing things, so, you know, as you're one of the 7 women and the few number of men, but, you know, it's a state of affairs, and things are different. You know, they do all kinds of really depressing studies that shows if job applications went out, one was a white man with no record, black man with no criminal record, white man with a criminal record, black man with a criminal record. The hierarchy of who's going to get that call back is the white man without a record and the white man with a record before the black man without a record. So they're really getting caught. They're getting stuck in a loop. We're getting to a situation where I've heard people argue in all kinds of different ways that because women have so much choice, men feel they have no reason to be responsible, which is a continuing conversation. But I think, as we've discussed in my class, I think we're going to see a new wave of man. I don't know if that makes any sense. But there's this wave, there's this generation of young men who are being raised by single women households and who understand that struggle and who know that it takes everybody doing their part. A funny stat that I always love is that the fastest group to get potty trained is children of single mothers. because she did not have time. She's playing around with those diapers. Well, think about that. You know, those young men are being taught early to cook, clean, get your stuff done, and be respectful to women, because they don't want to see they don't want to disrespect someone the way they may have seen their mother disrespected. And they're going to learn to break those generational curses, I almost call them.
Okay. It's piggybacking on what you.
The Civil War was over. 4 million former slaves gained the most basic rights of citizenship. The right to marry, raise children, own property, to be protected by law. Within 2 years, black men would have the right to vote. It was a time of great optimism. A whole generation infected with the possibilities of freedom and justice. Among them, Ida B. Wells. But by the time she was 21, this child of slavery would find that promises made were not to be kept. Wells would launch a campaign against oppression that reverberates throughout America to this day.
Before the close of the Civil War. My father was a son of his master, who owned a plantation in Tippah County, Mississippi, and one of his slave women, Peggy. My mother was born in Virginia and was one of 10 children. She and two sisters were sold to slave traders when young, and were taken to Mississippi and sold again. She used to tell us how she'd been beaten by slave owners and the hard times she had as a slave.
During the period after the Civil War, there was an opportunity of slaves, former slaves, to marry again in freedom under the auspices of the Freedmen's Bureau. And the Wellses got married again. And it was one of the first really social choices of freed people after the Civil War. And so obviously they were people of commitment, of family commitment, of commitment to each other. Her mother was a woman who, and I think this is very interesting, that when Ida went to school, she went to school, the mother as well.
8 times 4 is 32. 8 times 5 is 40.
For nearly a century, it was against the law to teach enslaved African people to read or write. At the end of the war, 90% were illiterate. Free now and hungering for an education, young and old attended thousands of newly opened public schools throughout the South.
Our job was to go to school and learn all we could. My father was one of the trustees, and my mother went along to school with us until she learned to read the Bible. All my teachers had been the consecrated white men and white women from the North who came into the South to teach us immediately after the war. It was they who brought us the light of knowledge and their splendid example of Christian courage.
The father used to ask Ida to read the newspapers to him, and mostly about what was happening politically in the community and in the country. Ida's father was what they used to call a race man, very involved in the politics of the period. So he was very, very much involved.
As Ida was growing up, the South was in convulsive change. Devastated by war, suffering crop failure, deprived of slave labor, the economy was in crisis. The African-American was the scapegoat. A massive propaganda campaign was unleashed in the press, the schools, and the church, reinforcing beliefs that black Americans were genetically inferior, that freed from bondage, they would revert to savagery. They had to be restrained. But for Ida Wells, the first great challenge in life had nothing to do with race. In 1878, the Mississippi Delta was hit by a plague called yellow fever. It struck down white and black alike.
Ida's family, both her parents, who were involved in trying to help others who were dying in that epidemic, caught yellow fever themselves and died within 24 hours of each other. A young sibling died as well. And so, at the age of 16, Ida Wells found herself and her family orphaned. There are three other siblings. She was the oldest. And trying to decide, you know, how to pull their life back together. And so some friends and also some family members gathered and decided to divide up the children to different friends and different family members. And also there was a young child who was crippled, and she, though, they felt would have to be institutionalized because no one wanted to take care of her. And Ida Wells said, and we go back to the influence of those parents, when she heard the plans, and she is 16 years old, she heard the plans and she said, my parents would turn over in their graves if they knew our family would be separated like this. I can't let it happen. And so that was the end of, in a very conscious decision, was the end of her childhood. She left school, made herself look older to get a teaching job.
Two years later, the veteran school teacher, Ida Bell Wells, moved to Memphis, 40 miles away on the Mississippi River. Wells, part of the migration of black people to the big cities of the South, found a better paying job in the Memphis school system. Spared destruction during the war, the city was thriving, a hub of commercial traffic for the entire South. City fathers envisioned Memphis as having the same exalted status as its namesake in ancient Egypt. When Ida arrived in Memphis, almost half of the population of the city was black.
Well, it was a period of great hope for black people. It was opening up of the society, and I think black people rushed into that void, hoping that this was going to be a new day.
And you think your grandmother was part of that optimism, Dr. Duster?
Oh, yeah. She was perhaps one of the most idealistic of that group. With everything in her later life indicated that she really believed that the country was opening up, that there was going to be full justice for black people.
As a school teacher, Wells was invited to join the Lyceum, a literary club. Black cultural and self-improvement societies were springing up all over the South. Many met regularly for music, recitations, and debates. Wells' club had its own newspaper, the Evening Star, and she was elected the editor. But there were other clubs. Back in 1866, a white social club called the Ku Klux Klan had begun a campaign of terror against black Americans, against any whites who dared speak out in their defense. Freed men looking for work in the city were rounded up and transported back to the countryside to pick cotton. In spite of a continuing climate of hostility, a small black middle class had begun to emerge throughout the South. Most had struggled up the economic ladder. Many had served in the Union Army, some finally settling on small farms. There were black shopkeepers, landowners, doctors, lawyers, councilmen, and state legislators. But democracy would be deferred. The North soon lost interest in the plight of the black American. In 1877, the last of the Federal troops were withdrawn from the South. Within 5 years, the Supreme Court overturned the federal laws that provided equality for African Americans. The states regained control of civil rights. The period known as Reconstruction was over. Southern states began to enact a series of laws to force the black citizen back into a subordinate class. A climate of intimidation was settling over the nation. A climate that was to radicalize the idealistic young schoolteacher, Ida B. Wells. In much of the South, segregation was fast becoming the law of the land. Wells, who had been exposed to the ideas of freedom and democracy, was not about to accept the new order.
One day, while riding back to my school, I took a seat in the ladies' coach of the train as usual. When the train started and the conductor came along to collect tickets, he took my ticket, then handed it back to me and told me I would have to go in the other car. I refused, saying that the forward car was a smoker. And as I was in the ladies' car, I proposed to stay. He tried to drag me out of the seat. But the moment he caught hold of my arm, I fastened my teeth in the back of his hand.
She fought. I had to bring in, I believe, two other conductors. And they physically took her off of that train. And when she's thrown off the train, even more humiliating is that the rest of the white passengers applaud.
Now virtually powerless, most black Americans believed they had no choice but to buckle under to the forces of segregation. But not 22-year-old Wells. She brought suit against the railroad and was awarded $500 in damages. The case was widely reported and celebrated by black people throughout the nation. But the railroad took the case to appeal. In 1887, the state Supreme Court reversed the decision.
Judgment reversed.
Wells had lost her fight. She made the following entry in her diary.
I had hoped for such great things from my suit for my people generally. I had firmly believed all along that the law was on our side and would, when we appealed to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief and utterly discouraged. And just now, if it were possible, would gather my race in my arms and fly away with them.
Despair gave way to fury. Wells wrote articles about her case that were published by the local papers and then by the leading black newspapers throughout the country.
She had to tell that story basically herself. She saw what that would do. There were a lot of black newspapers beginning to emerge, and a lot of them had been created by churches and by black religious organizations. The black church, of course, was independent. The black church didn't have to answer to any great degree to white owners.
And as a result of that, it's really the beginning of her career as a journalist. So it's important historically, but also important in terms of her own life. You see now there's a focus on it and a new kind of determination. She had found the meaning of her life, which was in her work as a journalist.
Signing her weekly column, Iola, Wells advocated self-help, education, and social reform. After exposing corruption and poor conditions in the Memphis school system, she lost her teaching job and became a full-time journalist.
She was called by other black journalists the princess of the press. And you get the very strong impression from the historical, what there is available, of historical record, that whenever Ida Wells showed up at a meeting of black journalists, that she was kind of the highlight. She was apparently a very personable woman, as well as a being a very beautiful woman, a very bright woman.
Wells soon became editor and a co-owner of the newspaper Free Speech. She now found herself writing about issues she had read about as a child. Racism and power. Blacks were attempting to gain power. Whites were unwilling to share it.
Over here across the river in Marion, Arkansas, in 1888, there was a big incident. The county had been ruled by or governed by elected black officials ever since Reconstruction. But that year, the whites rented about 1,000 Winchesters from Memphis, and they marched to the office of all of the black officials and said, "Now, the county is not big enough for you and us, and we got a one-way ticket for you to Memphis, and don't come back." So they marched them down to the railroad and put them on the train to Memphis. The governor in Arkansas said there's nothing he could do about it. Said if the people didn't want black officials, why? He couldn't do anything about it.
For black people, law and order was collapsing. Police not only tolerated, but in some cases even participated in mob violence. Lynch law was deliberately used to terrorize black Americans. Pamphlets like this incited more violence. This was the situation in 1892 when three young black men, Will Stewart, Calvin McDowell, and Thomas Moss, friends of Ida Wells, opened a grocery store in direct competition with a white-owned grocery across the street.
The white grocer didn't like it much, and so there was a bad blood between the white grocer and the black grocery store. He went to the city officials and tried to get them to, or the county officials tried to get them to close it down, said that they were maintaining a nuisance. They were selling beer. And when the deputy sheriffs arrived, now they didn't have uniforms, they were in plain clothes, it was after dark. Now you see some white folks with guns coming after you, why, blacks fired on them. You had gunfire, and a deputy was wounded. At that point, the truth must have come out, and so the blacks stopped firing, and the deputies went in and arrested all they could find in the grocery store. Then they went out and arrested everybody in the neighborhood they could find. And so they threw 20 to 30 people in jail.
Within hours, rumors of a black revolt spread throughout the county. A black militia was disarmed. The three grocers were dragged from their cells by a mob and murdered. The killers were never brought to justice.
Everybody in town knew and loved Tommy. An exemplary young man. He was married and the father of one little girl, Maureen, whose godmother I was. He and his wife, Betty, were the best friends I had in town. He owned his little home, and having saved his money, he went into the grocery business with the same ambition a young white man would have had. One of the morning papers held back its edition in order to supply its readers with the details of that lynching. It said that Thomas Moss begged for his life for the sake of his wife and his child and his unborn baby, that Calvin McDowell got hold of one of the guns of the lynchers, and because they couldn't loosen his grip, a shot was fired into his closed fist. There's a strong belief among us that the criminal court judge himself was one of the lynchers.
The black community of Memphis was stunned. Wells retaliated with her pen. She wrote an editorial.
The city of Memphis has demonstrated that neither character nor standing avails the Negro if he dares to protect himself against the white man or become his rival. The white mob could help itself to ammunition without pay. But the order was rigidly enforced against the selling of guns to Negroes.
Now, this is something that touched her not just as a woman who is sensitive to the injustices were being imposed upon blacks, but there was a personal note in it all that I think forced her to ask the question, am I willing to stand up to whoever may oppose me in trying to, in fighting for racial justice?
Wells chose to fight. She also chose her weapons.
There's therefore only one thing left that we can do. Save our money and leave a town, which will neither protect our lives and property nor give us a fair trial in the courts, but takes us out and murders us in cold blood when accused by white persons. Hundreds disposed of their property and left, leading pastors took their whole congregations with them as they, too, went west.
She said, leave. You know, this is that black migration to the Middle West, the Kansas and Oklahoma migration. Go to Kansas. Go to Oklahoma. And many blacks left. And I think that's another reason that the power structure was angry with her, because she understood the economic and political strategy that they were using to intimidate blacks. And what she was saying is, you don't have to stay here and be intimidated. Leave.
And so the white businesses were in a panic that blacks had left. They're buying everything on the installment plan, and they just left everything. So the people were left. The restaurants were going out of business because all the black patronage was going. And you talk about the power of the pen and of her leadership to be the force behind thousands of black people leaving, and whatever Memphis represented to them was the only thing that they knew. It was where their roots were, where they were working, where their families were. And 6,000 people packed up their bags, went to the Oklahoma Territory. Of course, Ida Wells had gone there previously to sort of scout the place. To get black people to leave everything and go to a place that's unknown. They don't know anything that's out there. The weather is different, the circumstances are different. It's, you know, the towns are, many of them yet to be established. And she did that when she was just a young woman.
Among those who remained in Memphis, Wells helped to organize a boycott aimed at the newly installed trolley system.
6 weeks after the lynching of Thomas Moss and his partners, the superintendent and treasurer of the City Railroad Company came into the office of the Free Speech and asked us to use our influence with the colored people to get them to ride on the streetcars again. When I asked why they came to us, the reply was that colored people had been their best patrons and that there had been a marked falling off of their patronage. I asked them what they thought was the cause. They said they didn't know. They had heard Negroes were afraid of electricity. When they left the office, I wrote this interview for the Free Speech and told the people to keep up the good work and to keep on staying off the cars.
She moved to a strategy of organizing, that she wanted to mobilize black people, women's groups in particular, but other kinds of black mobilization, which signaled that it wasn't only a matter of the mirror image. You don't just get people to see that they're wrong and they change. She saw that you had to get some organizational apparatus in place.
Wells used her paper to campaign against the growing number of lynchings, some involving mobs as large as 10,000 people. She described the carnival-like atmosphere in which black men, women, and children were hanged, shot, and burned to death for such offenses as non-payment of a debt, insulting whites, even testifying in court.
8 Negroes lynched since last issue of the Free Speech. 3 were charged with killing white men, and 5 with raping white women.
The charge of sexual assault against white women was routinely offered by the press and the authorities as the justification for these atrocities. Wells, at great risk, began to investigate these charges. One after the other proved false.
I also found that what the white man of the South practiced as all right for himself, he assumed to be unthinkable in white women. They could and did fall in love with the pretty mulatto and quadroon girls, as well as the black ones, but they professed an inability to imagine white women doing the same thing with Negro and mulatto men. Whenever they did so and were found out, the cry of rape was raised, and the lowest element of the white South was turned loose to wreak its fiendish cruelty on those too weak to help themselves.
Wells was now digging at the psychological roots of the sexual charges. She wrote an editorial about her findings.
Nobody in this section believes the old threadbare lie that Negro men assault white women. If Southern white men are not more careful, they will overreach themselves, and a conclusion will be reached which will be very damaging to the moral reputation of their women.
Wells was raising an unspeakable issue, suggesting voluntary relationships between white women and black men. It was an inflammatory idea. Outraged, the white press of Memphis rushed to the defense of white womanhood. Edward Ward Carmack, the fiery editor of the Memphis Commercial, led the attack, claiming that the black sets aside all fear of death for the gratification of his bestial desires. The Evening Scimitar had even more to say on the subject.
If the Negroes themselves do not apply the remedy without delay, it will be the duty of those whom he has attacked. Again, they're assuming that the writer of these editorials is one of the men associated with Ida Wells, to tie the wretch who utters these calumnies to a stake at the intersection of Main and Madison Streets, brand him in the forehead with a hot iron, and perform upon him a surgical operation with a pair of tailor's shears. Well, it's perfectly obvious what they were talking about there.
I bought a pistol the first thing after my friend Tom Moss was lynched, because I expected some cowardly retaliation from the lynchers. I felt that one had better die fighting against injustice than to die like a dog or rat in a trap. I'd already determined to sell my life as dearly as possible if attacked. I felt if I could take one lyncher with me, this would even up the score a little bit.
Wells was on a train headed for a conference in the East when the uproar over her editorial occurred. In New York, she learned that a committee of leading citizens had marched to her office, smashed the presses, and destroyed everything they could find. With a price on her head, Wells was now in exile. It would be 30 years before she would return to the South. Immediately, Wells was hired by the leading black newspaper, the New York Age, published and edited by T. Thomas Fortune, the dean of black journalists. By now, she was one of the most widely published writers in the black newspaper world. In the autumn of 1892, at the height of what was called the Gay 90s, Wells stumbled upon an unexpected source of power: the black women's club movement. She was asked to speak at a testimonial given in her honor at Lyric Hall in Brooklyn, New York. Women came from as far away as Philadelphia and Boston. It was reportedly the largest gathering of black club women ever held.
Like many another person who had read of lynching in the South, I had accepted the idea meant to be conveyed, that although lynching was irregular and contrary to law and order, unreasoning anger over the terrible crime of rape led to the lynching, that perhaps the brute deserved death anyhow, and the mob was justified in taking his life. But Thomas Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Will Stewart had committed no crime against white women. This was what opened my eyes to what lynching really was, an excuse to get rid of Negroes who were acquiring wealth and property and thus keep the race terrorized and keep the nigger down.
It was here that the first national anti-lynching campaign was born. The women collected $500 to enable Wells to continue her investigations into the causes of lynchings and to publish her first pamphlet on lynching.
During the slave regime, the southern white man owned the Negro, body and soul. It was to his interest to dwarf the soul and preserve the body. The slave was rarely killed. He was too valuable. But emancipation came, and the vested interests of the white man in the Negro's body were lost. With freedom, a new system of intimidation came into vogue. The Negro was not only whipped and scourged, he was killed.
Frederick Douglass, the most prominent black leader of the 19th century, wrote Wells, "Let me give you thanks for your faithful paper on the lynch abomination now generally practiced against colored people in the South. There has been no word equal to it." In one of her studies, A Red Record, Wells reported that during the year 1894, 197 persons were put to death by mobs who gave the victims no opportunity to make a lawful defense. These scenes of unusual brutality, she observed, failed to have any visible effect on the humane sentiments of the people of our land.
She knew that if she wasn't meticulous about it, that people would question her. And she made an effort of collecting all the data, the oral testimony as well as the written testimony that she could find. And again, she often used the white newspapers so that people could say, would not say, you are making these stories up.
Armed with these facts, Wells reached out to the conscience of America. But the press, the political establishment, the courts, and the church remained unmoved. 30 years after the Civil War, the most basic rights of black Americans were effectively subverted. Determined to be heard, Wells carried her crusade to England. Her strategy was to mobilize moral as well as economic pressures abroad. She understood just how critical the English market was to Southern cotton.
One newspaper made this comment: "We're naturally loath to express any opinion upon the way in which our American neighbors manage their own affairs, but when ruffians take to skinning men alive, vivisecting them, burning them slowly to death, no decent man can resent the expressions of horror and indignation that burst from the lips of all observers." That's just one of the things the British newspapers were saying as a result of what Ida Wells was reporting to the British.
During two European tours, Wells met with every leader of public opinion she could find, from the Archbishop of Canterbury to the Duke of Argyll. Working through English and Scottish women reformers, she helped launch the London Anti-Lynching Committee, the first anti-lynching organization in the world.
She had interviews with all of the leading newspapers, with people in Parliament. These interviews were written up, and she sent them back to the Memphis newspapers so they could see the nasty things being said about them. And so, of course, they had to reply to them and say they're not so, that this is really a great and a decent place for black people to live. And in saying the things weren't so, they said, "We're not for lynching, and we never have been." Now, of course, this wasn't true. But they she did persuade the Memphis business elite they had to do something. If they didn't, by their reputation would be ruined, be bad for them economically.
Though Wells was slandered in the American press, she had succeeded in making mob rule an issue of public debate. Lynchings soon began to decline. In Memphis, after 1894, there would be no lynchings for two decades. Returning home, Wells seized the occasion of the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893 to continue focusing international attention on racial injustice in America. Commemorating the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Columbus in America, it was the most spectacular World's Fair ever organized. But Black America was not represented at the fair. Wells published a pamphlet with Frederick Douglass and a Black Chicago lawyer named Ferdinand L. Barnett, pointing out that without centuries of the unpaid labor of Afro-Americans, there would be no Columbian Exposition. 20,000 pamphlets were distributed to foreign visitors.
When she pointed out why blacks were not represented at the Columbian Exposition, I think she did somewhat the same thing as she did in Memphis. I think she did, to some extent, show the white community for what it was, discriminating, racist. The people were embarrassed by it, whether even the people who tried to argue that it was a distortion, that it was not a true statement of the facts. There was a certain part of it they could not deny, and that was the blacks were not represented.
Wells settled in Chicago and continued writing. One of Wells' ongoing concerns was the unrelenting assault on the moral character of black women. She traveled about the country, speaking out on this and other racial issues.
Some black leaders, mainly Southern ministers, had a problem with her militancy because they felt she was rocking the boat. And we also speculate today, I mean, in hindsight, we can look back and say that they also probably had a problem with her because she was female and that she was speaking out. If they didn't have a problem with Frederick Douglass speaking out, but they definitely had a problem with her.
Wells had two battles to fight, racism and sexism. She joined the suffragist movement, organized the Alpha Suffrage Club, the first black women's suffragist group in Illinois, and campaigned with Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, and other white women leaders.
Ida never bit her tongue. And even among friends like Susan B. Anthony, she would challenge them. One season, she visited Susan B. Anthony in Rochester, New York, when she was lecturing. It was shortly after a women's suffrage meeting had occurred in Atlanta, Georgia, the first national meeting to be held in the South. And Frederick Douglass always attended these meetings. But Susan B. Anthony asked him, as a favor to her, not to come, because she knew that the women in the South, white women in the South, would be offended. And so she told this story to Ida, and Ida really admonished her. How could you do that? And you think I was wrong in so doing, Miss Anthony asked. I answered uncompromisingly, yes. For I felt that although she may have made gains for suffrage, she also confirmed white women in their attitude of segregation. I suppose Miss Anthony had pity on my youth and inexperience, for she never in any way showed resentment of my attitude. She gave me rather the impression of a woman who was eager to hear all sides of a question.
In the midst of this campaign, Wells made what some suffragists considered a radical move.
On 27 June 1895, I was married in the city of Chicago to attorney Ferdinand L. Barnett and retired to what I thought was the privacy of a home. The newspapers all over the country gave a good deal of space and mention of this fact. Three different dates had been set for the wedding, and every time a call had come to go someplace to deliver an address. When the announcement was made in the daily papers and through the Associated Press out to the country on June 12th, I was in Kansas delivering addresses nightly and spoke up to within a week of the day on which I